Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. A quorum is present. Just so to note for the public, members at this time of year often have to be in more than one committee at a time because committees are holding extra hearings to meet deadlines. So the folks may notice that members step in and out, and we know that happens, and we'll just try to accommodate that as best we can. If we need to hold bills or lay them over, pull them back up, I hope we don't have to do that, but, you know, so we may be a little bit in fits and starts today. So just first order of business is approval of the minutes of March 27th. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I move the minutes of March 27th. I move the approval.
All right. Thank you, Chair Scott. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of March 27th, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. So let's get right to it. We do have a very full agenda, as always. So the first bill on the agenda is House File 2233, Representative Niska. And this is going to be just an informational hearing because we have not gotten the bill referred to us in time. And I understand that Chair Scott is going to do the vote on it later on, right? So this is just in order to allow Representative Niska to present the bill and have some discussion on it if we need that. So Chair, Representative Niska, to your bill. Oh, and so we can't move it. So it's before the committee for informational purposes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Chair Scott and members of the Judiciary Committee. It's always exciting to be back here in the Judiciary Committee. Thank you to Representative Finke for your support joining me on this bill as a co-author. I'm carrying House File 2233 on behalf of the Uniform Law Commission, which is a nonpartisan multi-state group that tries to pass uniform laws, state laws that will be uniform across different states in order to provide for uniformity in areas where that's important. And the Uniform Special Deposits Act is trying to deal with a common type of banking product that doesn't currently have a good legal framework around it, which is special deposits, things that are deposited in a financial institution that'll be paid out based on some sort of a contingency. So think about an escrow account or something like that, a deposit, a security deposit, something like that. This creates an opt-in legal framework for those kinds of special deposits, and the Uniform Law Commission has brought this forward, and we're hoping that we can pass it in Minnesota. I do have with me two testifiers from the Uniform Law Commission to discuss the bill further as well.
All right. Thank you, Representative Niska. So I have Kim Lowe. Commissioner Lowe, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Kim Lowe. I'm one of Minnesota's Uniform Law Commissioners. I'm also a business law practitioner here in the Twin Cities. And I'm here to talk to you a little bit and answer any questions you might have about the Special Deposits Act. And then Commissioner Michelle Timmons will also give you an update on how this act is making its way across the country, which is good news. So as Representative Niska said, this is an act that's an enabling act. It's meant to allow for individuals and institutions when they want to establish an account, a special account, that is set up, not a checking account and not a savings account, but set up for a very special purpose. Usually it's an escrow account, or it could be an account that security deposits are put into for tenants when they rent something from a landlord. And what this bill does is it creates that framework that makes it very certain as to who owns that account. Or more precisely, it creates a certainty that the depositor, the person who actually puts the money into the bank account, is not the one who owns that account. It's not property for the purposes of that person. And the reason it's very important that it does that is because when and if that depositor, say it's a landlord or a business in a transaction, ends up having some economic tragedy and maybe has to file for bankruptcy, it makes it very clear that this account is not available as an asset without some steps to get through in the event of a bankruptcy. So it protects that account that special deposit account for the beneficiaries of that account, known or unknown, so that it makes it very difficult for it to be obtained in one of those proceedings. We, right now, as Representative Niska said, we don't have an absolute framework for this. Banks tend to have escrow agreements that they do. Some don't. Title companies sometimes have some issues or angst about these accounts because of this uncertainty. So what this act does is it allows the depositor and the institution to opt into this framework. And merely by saying we're opting into this, we're creating one of these special accounts under this sort of legal framework, it provides those protections. So it doesn't do any harm. It's a completely enabling statute. And I'm going to let, if anyone doesn't have any questions, I'm here to answer them. I can go through the whole act if you would like. Otherwise, yes, I didn't think so. Commissioner Timmons will tell you how it's making its way through the country, which is kind of exciting for one of our uniform acts to be doing that right now.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner Timmons. And if you could please be brief.
I'll be very brief for the tape, Madam Chairs and members. I'm Michelle Timmons, former reviser of statutes and here as a uniform law commissioner. This act, I think, really does have a specific purpose and fill a niche that was needed because it was just enacted, adopted by the Uniform Law Commission in 2023, and we already have seven enactments, including fairly close to us, North Dakota and Nebraska. There are eight introductions just this year. The act is moving in states such as Illinois, Arizona, New York. So I think that this does fulfill a special purpose, and you can see that it is gaining a lot of traction across the country. And that's my one bit of.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Timmons. Are there anyone in the audience who wants to testify on the bill? And I understand we probably won't take testimony again when the bill comes up, so this is your opportunity if you do want to testify on the bill. All right, so seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Representative Leader Niska for giving me the opportunity to sign on, and I appreciate the work of the commission, and thank you for doing it and support it.
All right. See no other discussion. Well, thank you very much for carrying this, Representative Niska, and we will bring it back when we have the bill before us. Thank you. Thank you, testifiers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, next on the agenda, we have House File 1999, Representative Green. And we had this bill before us before, and we laid it over, so I will move that House File 1999 be placed on the General Register. And we're going to bring up an amendment that Representative Green has been working on. And that is, let's see, we have the DE4 amendment, Representative Green. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And, let's see. Oh, and I'm sorry. So first we have to, we adopted, if we're going to adopt a DE4, a DE amendment, we probably don't need to reconsider an amendment we adopted before because that was the amendment to the old bill, and we're going to replace that with the DE4. So I will move adoption of the DE4 amendment. And before we adopt that, Representative Green, why don't you go ahead and tell us what the DE4 is doing because you've completely redone the bill for us here. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the DE4 amendment really revises this bill, and I just want to say that it's great to be back in judiciary. This is this bill that's related to anonymous data requests, and since I was last here, House File 1999 has really landed in good form, and we'll go over that in just a moment. But I'm just really appreciative of the collaboration with Mingoji, the Minnesota Newspaper Association, school boards, district administrators, and colleagues, especially Chair Scott, for your input on this. I really think that this bill now strikes this important balance between open government and accountability. It has also been expanded to include all government entities subject to FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, really holding them harmless from non-serious data requests and saving a lot of precious and valuable resources. So in practice, we also know that this bill has training and understanding of the law that's going to be important and an imperative piece of the solution. So I'm going to introduce our testifier who talks about the technical parts of this bill. Is that appropriate? Next step, Chair?
Yes, that's fine. All right. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, Representative Green, members of the committee. My name is Matt Ealing with Minnesotans for Open Government. I'm here to speak today in favor of the amendment to HF 1999. Our organization would like to thank Representative Green for her hard work on the amendment language and for working with Chair Scott to further refine that language to ensure that the best result is achieved. And I think what we have here in the form of this amendment is a very good piece of work. From a technical perspective, the amendment codifies existing guidance from various commissioners of opinion administration, commissioner of administration opinions about how to deal with large data requests, and it puts that guidance into statute. So large requests are contemplated and allowed under the Data Practices Act. Our own guidance as an organization to data requesters is always to be as specific as possible when making data requests in order to avoid unnecessary overbreath. But we do recognize that sometimes large requests are indeed necessary. You can look to the media's requests that they made after the I-35W bridge collapse as examples of large requests that served the public and benefited the public. So for years, because of the fact that large requests have been out there, the Department of Administration has issued guidance on how to respond to large requests, essentially by breaking them into components and to have the requesters then deal with the components by coming in to inspect the data or to retrieve the copies and then moving on to the next component of that request. So that's the process that this amendment would add to Chapter 13 explicitly. And it would be there clearly as guidance to both requesters and to government entities alike, and we think that's a positive development. So thank you again, Representative Green, for working on this, and I'm here to take any further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Thank you to your organization for working with Representative Green on this. It's important to a lot of folks. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on the bill, on the amendment? Okay, is there any discussion to the amendment before we adopt the DE4? All right, seeing none. So all in favor of adoption of the DE4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So any further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank the people at the testifiers table. Representative Green, you have been just really wonderful to work with on this, and really you delved in and you tried to understand the pluses and minuses of the original language, I think, and you worked really closely with Minnesotans for Open Government. I'm still trying to get used to saying that, and Mr. Neumeister, and I just really appreciate your collaboration, because what seemingly was an easy bill, a simple bill, turned out to be anything but that. And so my hope always is with data practices is that when someone like Representative Green, who is green on data practices, when she brings something like this, she really delves in and tries to learn the background of why that statute might be the way that it is. And so I'm just so appreciative of all the work that you did and all the back and forth. And I know you were up late and early in the morning and sending emails. So I highly commend you. And thank you, Mr. Ealing, as always, for working with Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Scott. I echo those sentiments. Any other comments or questions for members? Oh, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think this is such an elegant solution to address the issues that you brought this bill to address, but also taking into account the really important interest in government transparency. And just this process exemplifies like what the legislative process can look like at its very best. So nice job. And thanks for your work on this bill. I think it's really important.
All right, any final words, Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I just want to say is first of all, thank you for the kind and generous comments that were made. I really appreciate that. We have to protect that the public has every right to request data from a government entity, no matter the topic. And so I think one of the things that is just important for us to always remember is at least for me, a lesson in this is just to really focus on the basics of the bill and not the subjective piece of it, which I think sometimes can get convoluted. And so I'm really excited for this bill to go, hopefully make it across the finish line. It's important for transparency, for the integrity of what it means to have an open government. I really think it's a win-win, and it really ensures that we have responsible stewardship of taxpayer dollars across the state, which is the number one thing right now. So members, I encourage you to support.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Green. So I will renew the motion that House File 1999, as amended, be placed on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Next on the agenda, we have House File 1995, the first engrossment, Representative Frederick. And the motion, I will move that House File 1995 be re-referred back to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee, from which it came, I assume. And I don't think we have an amendment, so I think we're all set. And welcome to the committee. Representative Frederick, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 1995 is a pretty simplistic bill in that it changes some language from being an SUD assessment to saying comprehensive assessment because we look at people as whole human beings and people are complex. And the other thing that it does is that saying that if the comprehensive assessment can be covered under Medicaid, we want it to be paid by Medicaid instead of a fine being assessed to the person who will hopefully be receiving services. Simple bill.
Okay. So we have a testifier, I believe, by Zoom.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead, please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Selena Beasley, and I am an enrolled member of the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians. I'm the administrative officer for the Red Lake Chemical Health Program and a certified alcohol and drug counselor. I also serve as governor of Region 1 on the MARCH board, a statewide association of substance use disorder programs and professionals. I'm here to speak in support of House File 1995, court ordered payment for comprehensive assessments covered by Medicaid or the Behavioral Health Fund. Currently, Minnesota Statute 169A.284 prohibits individuals convicted of a DWI the ability to utilize their Medicaid insurance or the Behavioral Health Fund to pay providers for the comprehensive assessment. These individuals were told that they had to pay out of pocket in the neighborhood of $200. These individuals face numerous challenges, and this is a barrier we would like to eliminate. When this bill was heard in the Human Services Committee, there were multiple letters of support from agencies dealing with how this impacted clients and their programs. The first one was from Robert Bob Christie, who works for the Beltrami County DWI Diversion Program as a court agent. Terry Tell Busher from Stellar Area Program for Recovery. Mindy Bruden from Sanford Behavioral Health and the SUD program. And the Red Lake Nation Chemical Health Program. The second section of this bill has instructions to the reviser to modernize the outdated term chemical dependency. The section had input from Senate Counsel, the Department of Public Safety, and the Department of Human Services. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for your time and consideration, and I welcome any questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. So I have on my list here, there's another testifier just for questions, if there are any. And is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frederick, if you could just expound a little bit on the rationale behind the testifier stated that the term chemical dependency is outdated. What's the thought process there? What's changed that makes that term no longer appropriate?
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I think that people who are in the industry probably could talk to that better than I could, but changing the term to comprehensive assessment, I mean, that's part of the goal of the bill. It's just trying to change that language, right? And part of that is looking at all of the co-occurring disorders that happen at the same time. Often people who, or not often, but it can be a space where someone who suffers from substance use disorder could have something else going on, and some of the screening wants to look at them as a whole person instead of saying we want to just this one narrow lane. I think that would be the simplest way to describe it, if that answers your question.
Representative Hudson? Okay. Other questions? Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick. One question that I have, does this change anything that has to do with Medicare or Medicaid coverage? Because it's no longer a substance abuse or chemical dependency, it is now seen as a comprehensive test.
Representative Frederick.
If I'm understanding the question, your question is, does the change away from substance use disorder to comprehensive assessment change its access to Medicaid dollars? I mean, if that's, I think if I'm kind of rephrasing the question that way, and if that's true, I'm just going to roll with it. No, it wouldn't change that. I mean, the backside of the bill does interact with Medicaid in that we're looking for Medicaid to pay for the assessment, but it wouldn't, the change in the language wouldn't impact at all. If that makes sense.
Representative Engen, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't mean to put you on the spot here. How did it interact differently? I think that was what you said, that it's going to change some interactions and that Medicaid is going to be paying for that assessment. Can you run me through how that would work?
Representative Frederick.
Sure. So the goal with this is that someone who goes through let's say the criminal justice system and needs to take this assessment. The courts could say you then have to pay for that assessment. And so what this bill is looking to do is to have Medicaid pay for that assessment instead of the individual. And so that's kind of how it would interact with Medicaid.
So my understanding, this would be lines 2.7 to 2.10 of the bill, and it simply says that the court must not order the person to pay for it if the assessment is eligible for reimbursement already.
Correct.
So you're not expanding eligibility. You're just trying to make sure that the payment is applied where it could be applied.
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So other questions or comments? Okay, and just so members know, and kind of following on Representative Engen's question, there is a fiscal note requested, I understand, and if there's a cost to this, the cost will be carried in Human Services, and that's why we're sending it back to Human Services. So I think the cost question is a good one, an important one, but we're not really going to handle that in this committee. Okay. Other question, Representative Engen? No. Okay. Anyone else? All right, seeing no further questions, so I will renew the motion that House File 1995 be re-referred to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred. Thank you, Representative Frederick. Okay, next one is House File 1614, the first engrossment. Representative Kraft. And the motion here, I will move that House File 1614 be placed on the General Register. And I don't think we have an amendment.
We do not.
So welcome to the committee, Representative Kraft. The bill is before us. Please go ahead and present.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Madam Chair Scott as well. It's great to be here. This is one of those things that when I heard about it, I say, no, it can't be happening, but it actually is. This bill will put into statute a policy adopted by DHS in 2023 to not screen into child protection families who cannot safely bring a child home that has a serious mental illness or to a treatment facility due to lack of services. So despite this policy being in place since 2023, NAMI Minnesota and the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities continue to hear from families who are being referred to child protection. These are families who are engaged with and love their child, but their child's needs are very complex. Several have even been adopted out of the child protection system and thus have experienced trauma. And to be clear, the situation is then they can't find place in residential treatment somewhere, and they're at a emergency room or something, and then being referred to child protection because they can't safely bring their kids home. These folks have often placed their children on waiting lists for residential treatment, applied for community access for disability inclusion or CADI waivers, and much more. But the wait lists are long, and it's very hard to find people to work with your child when they have extreme or aggressive symptoms. Also, just because a family is referred to child protection doesn't mean that services will become available. They won't, because they don't exist. But referring these families to child protection can put them at risk of losing their jobs and custody of their other children. What's happening is akin to blaming families and makes their lives harder. We need to support them and help them. Now I have a couple of testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kraft. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairs. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we strongly support this bill. There are children with complex needs, often symptoms that are aggressive or the child is homicidal or suicidal. There are children so dysregulated or with histories of extreme trauma that they are lashing out. They are brought to the ER or hospitalized, and then when the hospital wants to discharge them and the family doesn't believe they can keep them or other family members safe and they refuse to take the child home, they are threatened with being reported to child protection. And I want to make it very clear, we're talking about very highly engaged parents. They are not neglecting their child. The system is. We simply don't have enough services and supports for these children. They have often placed the child on every single wait list that exists for intensive services or residential treatment. They have already desperately called every agency they can find to ask for help. And while there is a policy already in place, we still experience on a monthly basis hospitals referring children to child protection and counties screening them in. We have heard hospitals say that counties tell them the only way to get services is through the child protection door. And yet we have the Children's Mental Health Act, and some of these families actually already have a Children's Mental Health case manager. And to make it clear, child protection does not have a magic wand. They cannot magically make these services for these children suddenly appear. By putting these families in child protection, you're threatening their jobs and their ability to keep their family together. Referring these families to child protection simply does not solve the problem. Because the screening guidelines are being ignored, NAMI adamantly believes that we need to put this language into statute. I urge you to support this bill. Let's not make it harder for these families. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. We have a testifier on Zoom. If you're there, welcome to the committee, and please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Wood. I live in rural Goodhue County with my husband of nearly 22 years and our five children. Our daughter came to us the week of her first birthday, is known for her giant dimples and her love of cats and ducks. She has struggled with suicidal ideations, self-harm, and acting out behaviors for years. She has diagnoses of ADHD, depression, learning disabilities, and reactive attachment disorder. She was in kindergarten the first time we carried her out of the store screaming that she wanted to kill herself. 2024 was a rough year with multiple psychiatric hospitalizations and a 10-day stay at the Southeastern Minnesota Regional Crisis Center after assaulting me and one of her sisters, an incident that scared her. After CIRC, she started new medication. We changed therapists to one who did animal-assisted therapy and EMDR. We began to see progress. Then, on December 8th, my husband David was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and the bottom fell out of our world. On one of the coldest days in January, she ran out of the house with no coat and no shoes. My 11-year-old followed his safety plan and locked himself in his room while her sisters and I ran after her. As her sisters put themselves between her and the road, she started assaulting them, even grabbing one by the throat. I caught up with them and stopped her, and then she laid down in our field, unresponsive for nearly an hour, until sheriff's deputies convinced her to go in the house. She was taken by ambulance to the hospital, and then to CERC. While at CERC, she had inappropriate sexual, assaultive, and self-harming behaviors, and was taken by ambulance to the hospital before being transferred to an inpatient adolescent psych unit. We spent hours working with our children's mental health case manager and our private health plan advocate to get her approved for residential care. We begged hospital staff to work with our case manager and advocate to help us find a safe place for her until she could go to Girard, to no avail. Despite telling hospital staff we didn't have an adequate safety plan for my husband's upcoming chemo treatment on Tuesday, they said she was discharging on Saturday and we needed to pick her up. We declined to do so. Because I'd spoken with NAMI, I knew we shouldn't be screened in to child protection, but it wasn't a guarantee. In the following days, we fielded multiple calls threatening to report us to child protection, even though CERC had also refused to admit her because she had endorsed homicidal ideations during their interview. On Tuesday morning, during chemo, I received a call from a psychiatrist telling me they were making that report. So after chemo, and against our better judgment, we brought our daughter home. The only discharge advice from the hospital was if she gets aggressive and hurts someone, call 911 and press charges. The day before being admitted to Girard, she assaulted her best friend while at school, and that happened. We tried desperately to get our daughter the care she needed. This time she needed more. We put key locks on all the bedroom doors. We added motion cameras to record the interior and exterior of our home. We added driveway alarms. We clearly were not neglecting our daughter. My daughter deserved better care than let the justice system deal with her. The rest of my family deserved to be safe. Our choices were to be charged with neglect and fight that battle while fighting cancer, or risk the safety of our family. All of you here today have the power to change that for the next family, and I beg you to do so. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wood, for your testimony, and we all wish you the best, and thank you for sharing that very difficult story with us. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right, seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kraft, for your bill. Cyber Holden, for your work. I'm just curious. I appreciate this, right? We need to protect families. What we really need to do is protect these kids. And I'm just curious, when you look ahead, this question is for Ms. Abelholden. Are these residential treatment facilities, the places that we know can help, are they going to get more difficult to access or less difficult to access as you look ahead in the next 3 to 5 years?
Ms. Abelholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, we lost a lot of residential beds during the last decade, and so I really am concerned about our ability to meet the needs of these children. We know if we have psychiatric residential treatment facilities, which are a higher level of care than our current residential, that could be helpful. But again, sometimes the Medicaid rates are low, and that makes it really hard to expand our services. So do I think we're going to meet these children's needs in the future? No, I don't.
Yeah, Representative Finke.
Thank you for that assessment. This is a good small step forward, but very small towards solving this problem. So let's work together. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Representative Finke. And just for members to note, there is a fiscal note of zero in our packet. Okay. Representative Kraft?
Yeah, I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, just respond. I recognize that this is a Band-Aid on a very difficult issue. But, the solution certainly is more treatment for folks like this that need this so we don't back up in our hospitals. And, well, I think that is up to our control, I know, in a very tough budget year. But this obviously shows the needs that are there.
Yeah, thank you. Other member question, comment? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions, Representative Kraft, and maybe your testifier can answer this too. How widespread is the problem? How often are we seeing this play out?
Ms. Abelholden?
Madam Chair, between the Ombudsman's Office and NAMI's Office, it's a couple a month.
Okay. And
Chiska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is that the reason for the zero fiscal note? It's because it's a couple of cases a month? If Representative Kraft knows, or I.
Ms. After Holden?
Madam Chair, it's because there isn't really a cost associated with not referring families to child protection, but instead trying to get them services.
Okay.
So there wouldn't be a cost there.
Okay, perfect. And then, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Scott.
And I'm wondering, are the, you know, there are other stakeholders probably in this, like the Association of Social Workers and the Minnesota Hospital Association, are they fine with the language and this bill?
Representative Kraft?
Madam Chair, we haven't received, there were some questions about some of the language in an earlier version that we updated and then addressed the concerns that we had heard. I haven't heard concerns from those folks. Maybe Ms. Abderholden has.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, because we moved it from 260C, which is kind of once you get in the child protection door, to 260E, which is the screening part, they were okay with it. And again, it's a current policy with the Department of Human Services. We're just putting it into statute.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for answering those questions. I appreciate the clearer picture.
Thank you. Other questions or comments from members? All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1614, the first engrossment, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and on you go. Thank you.
Thank you, committee.
Let's see. Some representatives are already in. Okay. So we're going to skip around a little bit, members, just so we can, with Representative Curran presenting in another committee. So we've got House File 2781, Representative Pinto. And so I will move that House File 2781 be placed on the general register. And there is an author's amendment that is, let me just get mine out here. And I think that's a technical amendment. Or do we have that? Oh, that was handed out. Yeah, that was handed out separately. It's not in your packets, members. 2781, the A1 amendment. So I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. Representative Pinto, did you want to say anything about the A1? Is it just technical?
It is. It was suggested by House Research, in fact, Madam Chair.
All right. Very good. So let's adopt that then. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair and members. House File 2781 relates to my work as a prosecutor of gender violence and domestic violence. It makes small change to our order for protection service statute, and I'll have the testifier describe the bill and the substance of it.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Sammy Sexton, and I'm a supervising attorney at Standpoint, which is a statewide organization that supports victim survivors of domestic and sexual violence. The current language defining a custodian for purposes of the Order for Protection statute went into effect just last year on August 1st, 2024. And immediately when it went into effect, Standpoint began receiving several calls on our action line from victim survivors, advocates, and attorneys asking for clarification on the language and who it actually applies to. The current definition appeared to apply to individuals like teachers, babysitters, and daycare providers who would be providing care to a minor child even on a temporary basis. This confusion was causing hesitation among victim survivors about whether they were willing to file for an order for protection because they didn't know who would need to be notified of the intimate details of their abuse. So the goal of the amended language is to clarify that a custodian only includes individuals with custody or parenting time with a minor child pursuant either to statute, court order, or the consent of a custodial parent. That clarification will help victim survivors and the professionals they work with know who must be listed as a custodian in their order for protection petition so that they'll know who is going to receive notice of that petition. And so we would ask the committee to pass this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. So is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Okay. I'm not seeing anyone. Members, questions, comments? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Pinto, I was thinking that this bill was in response to Representative Erdahl's bill last year. Is that correct?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Scott, that is correct. So just to remind members, the Erdahl bill added custodians to the list of people who need to be notified of hearings. And remember, there was a concern in that case where the grandmother in his district had not been notified of a change in order for protection, want to make sure she was notified. But the definition of a custodian was very broad. So yes, this narrows that to the group that we probably intended in the first place.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so in the case of a grandmother that maybe they haven't gone through all the legal channels for her to be, in essence, the custodian of a child, do they have what does it do in that situation, the change in the language?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Scott. So line 2.20, custodian includes someone who has physical legal custody of the child with the consent of the custodial parent. So as long as the grandmother has the consent of the child's custodial parent, then the grandmother is covered in this situation, as I believe in the situation of Representative Erdahl District, that was the case.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. So does this also now exclude informal caregivers in any and all circumstances?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, Representative Engen, as long as the person has physical or legal custody under the section provided with the consent of the custodial parent, then in fact that would, it may well have been the grandmother in Representative Earl's district. It was an informal arrangement. I suspect it probably was. It wasn't like a contract or anything, right? But that would be covered.
Representative Engen? Okay. Other discussion? All right. Seeing no further discussion, any final words, Chair Pinto?
No, thank you, Chair and members, for considering the bill. This will be an important narrowing to make the change we made last year, last term, work well.
All right. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2781, as amended, be placed on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and on its way. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, so we have another bill from Chair Pinto. So House File 1775. And so my motion there will be that House File 1775 be re-referred back to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. So there is an author's amendment, the A3, and Chair Pinto, do you want to describe the bill and then tell us what the amendment does before we adopt it?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So members, the bill as a whole is about putting in one place information about how our pretrial detention system and pretrial justice system works. I think we all have, especially those on the public safety side, but I think those of you in the judiciary as well, have a strong interest in knowing how is the system actually working. And right now, we do not have good data to understand that. So the proposal is to put all that in one place and then have reports and analysis so that we can understand the answers to such questions as, are there folks who are being let out who are committing new crimes, for example, or folks who are in that position? Are there people who are being held in custody for certain lengths of time based on the amount of money they can put up as bail, et cetera? What the amendment does is to focus the bill really in this kind of the continual process of saying that it's simply those institutions that have this information already available, the courts and Department of Corrections, to send them one place to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and then there's information in the amendment about the report and information that we will get back from the Guidelines Commission. So I'd ask members to support that amendment.
All right. So I will move the A3 if I didn't already. Is there any discussion to the A3? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A3 is adopted. So, Chair Pinto, to the bill as amended, if you would, because I kind of get the sense that from the weak vote here that maybe members are a little confused about what we're doing here. So please go ahead and discuss the bill as amended.
Thank you, Sherry. I was going to hand it straight to the testifier, but good point. Based on the vote, maybe I'll say just a minute longer. So members will see, because I always like to look at the actual bill in front of us, that the DOC and courts, will be required to report information that is already in their possession. So you'll see on that first page, for each person, it's going to be their name, their year of birth, race and ethnicity, et cetera, a long list of information that they're required to send to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Again, right now, if you ask a question like, how many people are being held pretrial in this state? We don't have that information. We say, what's the average bail that's set? By the way, what's the average bail that's set in Hennepin versus some other county? This county versus a neighboring county? What happens there? We don't have any information on that that's gathered that we could get. You have to go painstakingly, and testifiers had to try to do that. And so what this does is puts in one place, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission then provides information and reports on the information that has then been gathered, an analysis. And you'll see in the amendment on page 2, there's a list on this A3 amendment that you just adopted, a list of the kind of pieces of information that we'll be looking for to understand the system. And so we'll get a report on that, including some recommendations for better information gathering. And I'll just say, whatever your perspective on pretrial, the pretrial detention system, whatever you think, it will be helpful to you and to us to have information that you can point to say, this is happening here, that's happening there. We can't do any of that right now. So with that, I think time to turn to the testifier, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Chair Pinto. And before we do that, I noticed there are blank appropriations here, and this is going back to public safety. And I assume that any cost will be carried in public safety?
Correct, Chair.
All right. Thank you. Chair Moeller is nodding, too. So, okay. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairs Liebling and Scott, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Anna Hall. I am the project lead for the Minnesota Justice Research Center's Pretrial Best Practices Project. I'm also an attorney at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis. In 2023, the legislature asked the MNJRC to take a look at best practices on pretrial issues, and we issued two reports, one February 15th of last year and one February 15th of this year. Our preliminary report recommended exactly what this bill does, which is to create a statewide data infrastructure to study pretrial practices here. Without a standard system of data collection in Minnesota, our pretrial system lacks transparency. Minnesotans simply don't know how it works, what it does, and you know what the impacts are on their communities across the state. Chair Pinto noted the questions that we can't answer. I'll note a couple others for the committee. We don't know how often people across the state fail to appear for court hearings. We don't know whether people held pretrial in Minnesota are more likely to plead guilty than those who are released pretrial. We don't know whether posting cash bail makes someone more likely to come back to court in Minnesota. These are very basic questions to assess whether our pretrial system is working as it should, and we don't have the answers to those questions. We have some indication from research across the country, but we just don't know for Minnesota specifically. Members, Minnesotans deserve to know whether the policies that affect their lives are consistent with the values that they hold, values like safety and equity. And as it stands, our current system makes it difficult to demonstrate whether we're achieving those goals. So I urge you to adopt the recommendations of the MNJRC in this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And I would just point out to members, there's in your packet, there is a small packet of letters, and they come from all over the place. And I see that there's one here from the Center for the American Experiment and New Justice Project and Board of Public Defense, Justice Action Network, Legal Rights Center, so they're kind of all over. This seems to be very broadly supported. I think everybody wants to know what's going on and do it in a way that respects privacy as well. Mm-hmm. So are there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, and seeing none, we'll open it up to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Expounding upon the conversation we had in public safety when we heard this earlier, I noticed in your amendment you changed some language, and the reference to nonprofits is different now. I guess my question is, do you anticipate the Sentencing Guidelines Commission having any exclusion of any particular nonprofits, or like, is it basically anybody who wants to come to the table can come to the table? It's not directly addressed in your language, but I'm just trying to understand intent.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Hudson. Yeah, no, I don't, not contemplating anything or anyone in particular, right? What we want is to get good information back. We're charging the Sentencing Guidelines Commission with that. I'm acknowledging that we want them to be consulting with all kinds of folks, including major criminal legal agencies, et cetera, but then also community groups. But there's not, not contemplating that they're going to do anything in particular with any particular group.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate explaining that there's no limitation on who can participate.
Okay. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's interesting. I was thinking about a bill that I carried last term that passed that was around the use of risk assessment instruments for youth. And, you know, it's laid out in the Center for the American Experiments letter kind of what we should be striving towards, a standardized public safety threat evaluation tool to be used for pretrial release decisions. And it just strikes me that I was looking at, like, what do we want before we have the information about, like, what are the issues and what are we trying to address? And so I just think this is a really good bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. And I just wanted to thank the Minnesota Justice Research Center for their work and just let folks know that the report is very well done. And it is, I just double checked, and it's on your website at mnjrc.org if members want to take a look or anybody from the public. And then I just wanted to note, too, there was a pretty in-depth Star Tribune article on Sunday following first appearances in Hennepin County. Oh, yeah. And Setting Bell. It was just really interesting. So just wanted to mention that as something to look at as well. And thanks for sending this bill back to the Public Safety Committee. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Fraser.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Rep. Pinto, thank you for carrying this bill. I know you've been working on this issue for a little bit, and I know it's something that I got engaged in when I came to the legislature, so I appreciate you continue to lead on it. And to MNJRC, thank you for the work that you did on the report. It was very well put together, very thoughtful, very detailed, very insightful. And all I have to say is, and I have just a comment, is that, you know, when we're talking about creating a system that is fair and just, there's no way we can do that without understanding where the disparities are, where the fault lines are, where the barriers are, to ensure that we have a fair and just system. And the basic questions that you laid out there, we need to know the answer to those in order to do that. So I'm looking forward to what comes out of this and how we continue to make our system better.
All right. Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, my understanding is that I think in public safety you had an A1, and it removed a dashboard that you were going to have that would have made the information open to the public, and that's been removed. So my question is, if you're gathering all this data, but the public is not able to see the data, but only a small number of folks are going to be able to see it, what's the value?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Scott. I should say that there's the reason that dashboard was in the bill originally is because there's great interest, and I've talked to Ms. Hall and others, in having a dashboard. The concern is a significant reason was taken out was because of cost, because the understanding we were getting from agencies was that there would be a substantial cost for it. And we will get information back through the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I think be in position where policymakers and others can say, these are research questions that we want answered, so we're going to get information back. But again, there's great interest in having a dashboard. I think, looking at Chair Mueller, it is not a guarantee that we get this version of this term. I know Chair Mueller and Chair Novotny will do their very best, but then also paying for the dashboard as well felt like a step too far at this time. But there is great interest in that. In the meantime, we'll get a lot of great information back. Oh, you want to ask? Oh.
Yeah. Ms. Hall.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, Chair Scott, for the question. I would just say, looking at other states that have done something similar, collected the data and published it via sentencing guidelines commissions or others, the reports that they provide are quite robust, and those reports are made available to the public. And so, assuming that, you know, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission receives the kind of robust data that this bill is designed to provide to them, they will be able to conduct analysis that answers a lot of the questions that we currently have.
Yeah, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, is there a reason that you couldn't post all of the data on a website somewhere? The Sentencing Guideline Commission, maybe they have all the raw data there.
Chair Pinto.
And Madam Chair and Chair Scott, actually Chair Liebling sort of alluded to this. I mean, there are privacy and other concerns with having, if you look at the raw data here, all this information, having all of that up just as raw data, I think is something that that I think many of us would have concerns about. The questions we're trying to answer have to do with, and I want to point out how robust these questions are on page 2 of the A3, and certainly if folks have thoughts about other things that they want, but the questions we want to answer are the ones that Ms. Hall and I brought up, and the other ones listed on page 2. Those questions require, like, analysis and looking at the relationship between things. Having every bit of raw data accessible on a website at all time, I think, would intrude on people's privacy and just would not be something that I think would be a good call. And also, Madam Chair, if I can just add, and it would also go against the court's data practices limitations, which we have imposed as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Oh, Chair Scott, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I mean, I think there's some like the names and known aliases. There's some, I think you could go through this list of data that you're trying to collect and classify some of it as private or not public. But I think if you're going to be having, I just want to make sure that it's done in a non-biased way, the reports and stuff. I want that to be done in a non-biased way. And the only way to determine whether that's non-biased or not is to have more of the raw data. So if there's a way of classifying certain pieces of this as not public, I think that would be a good approach. And I know what you mean by wanting to get more information. I've worked on family law a lot. And what we don't know, because the court doesn't keep the data on it, is in dispositions where, custody is decided, we'd like to know how often shared parenting is happening, whether it's 50%, 40%, who gets, all the things. We'd love to see data on that. And in the past, we've had just private individuals go to a handful of different counties and dig through court files to find that information. So I understand the value in the data, and I do know from asking the court at one time just kind of in passing that there would be a large fiscal note just to collect the data that small amount of data that we're wanting. So it'll be interesting to see what they come back with the fiscal note. But I think we all want the information. It's just how it's presented, how much of it's presented, and at the end of the day, what the courts are going to charge or whoever's going to charge to get it. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Scott. And, I think you make a very good point. Maybe this is just the beginning of something, and maybe there's a way to figure this out as we go along when they're collecting the data. And another thought that I have on it is that perhaps the data could be made available to researchers, not posted somewhere, but made available, with restrictions around it in terms of releasing individual data the way we often do with, sometimes health-related data or other kinds of data. I mean, there might be ways to accomplish that. And I think it's, being able to find out what the data really show is a benefit to everybody, but we do need to balance that. So seeing no other, oh, we do. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the testifier mentioned that this is already being done in other states. Do you have a list of those states so that we can check into that before it gets to public safety?
Off the top of my head, Virginia is the most recent one that has done something very similar, utilized their Sentencing Guidelines Commission to accomplish this. I can pull a list of the other states, though, and have them sent to you.
Thank you. All right. Seeing no other comments, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1775, as amended, be re-referred to the first engrossment. I'm very negligent in not saying that. House File 1775, the first engrossment, as amended, be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And the bill is on its way back. All right, we've got Representative Curran. And Representative Curran has two bills. The first being 1316, House File 1316. And let's see. Representative Curran's motion will be that House File 1316, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. Is that your motion, Representative Curran?
Yes, that's correct, Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So the bill is before the committee, and I don't think we have an amendment, so go ahead and speak to your bill.
Wonderful. Thank you again, both chairs and committee members, for hearing House File 1316. This is another bill that has to do with collection of child support. I'll turn it over to my testifier in a second to explain the details, but essentially what we're looking to do is collect accurate income reports to ensure that children are receiving the supports that they need. There are some gaps in the system where folks are being paid to do work, but then that's not being reported, and then it ends up in children again, like I said, not receiving the support that they might need. So with that, I will turn it over to our testifier.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Trish Skullpammer, and I serve as the Director of Child Support Services for the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. What this bill would do, as Representative Curran has said, is require that people who work as independent contractors or in the gig economy are reported to a system of new hire reporting so that those of us who work in child support know what their earnings are and know where they're working so that we can get child support orders set accurately and so that we know where to send notices for income withholding. Currently, all people who work as regular W-2 employers are required to be reported to the new hire reporting system, and the government as an employer is required also to report people who work as independent contractors, but other employers are not required to do so. And we also know that there's been a huge increase in the number of people who work in different types of jobs that are either independent contractors or doing work like driving for Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, things like that, and those people are not showing up in our system accurately for us to know how to establish child support orders and where to send those income withholding notices. So there's a missed opportunity here, and we're hoping that this bill will help close that gap.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone, so we will close the testimony and go to member discussion. Member discussion. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Curran, for carrying the bill. I think I have the clone or whatever. There was a kind of confusion who was carrying what this year, but no, this is a good bill. We need to, you know, anyone that has a child support order needs to abide by it, and sometimes they run under the radar. And so, thank you to the testifier for fashioning a bill that makes sure that kids get what they are entitled to.
Thank you. Other questions or comments from members? All right, seeing none, final comments, Representative Curran.
Yes, thank you again, Chair Liebling and Chair Scott. I appreciate your comments. We've carried clone bills, like you said, together because these are good ideas. We need to make sure getting the resources they need and that folks aren't dodging responsibility when it comes to supporting children. I will note that there is some further discussion happening on the language surrounding independent contractors and things like that. So we fully expect that with the motion to move to workforce today, that we will get it in good shape for that committee later this week as well.
All right, thank you. So I so Representative Curran renews the motion that House File 1316, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. And we will now move to House File 2127. Representative Curran. And this motion will be Representative Curran's motion is going to be that House File 2127 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And there is an amendment. Is that correct, Representative Curran?
Yes, that is correct. Would you like me to describe the amendment?
Okay. Let's see. We have two? We have two amendments. And so let's see. Which one of these did you want to move, Representative Curran, first? So you want to move the A1. Okay, I'm sorry. So the A1 was adopted already.
That's correct.
And when the bill was before us before. And so you have the A2 amendment today to, so why don't you describe the, so you want to move the A2, so let's move the A2. You're moving the A2 to get it before us.
Yes.
And then please go ahead and describe the A2.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we had full testimony and discussion on this bill earlier and took an amendment. And since then, we've come back with another amendment before you as the A2. This is the result of a lot of discussions with our members, chairs, stakeholders, and I think we've gotten this bill to a pretty good spot now. And it's a compromise position. So first, it removes Section 5 that creates a new crime with regard to forgery. Not that we don't want to do that, but it would require an additional stop at another committee, and we're trying to get the most done that we can with this bill in this session. So this has been a work in progress since it started last year and will continue to be in work in progress is my expectation. But this is to get it to the point where it's workable for us today. The second change is that we're removing judicial branch employees in the property records provision. There was a great concern for county recorders that allows for a much greater number of people that this would apply to. And so in the interest then of the third part that we removed, removing the penalty fee if a judicial official failed to give the required notice that they no longer qualify, we had put in that there would be a fee up to $500 in there. And I think that just didn't feel quite right for folks to charge a judge in that way. And so these three combined represent a negotiation and a compromise between all parties involved, and I appreciate the support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Curran. So let's adopt the A2 amendment, and then we'll have the bill in its preferred shape. And then it is a little bit confusing with the two different amendments, but let's adopt the A2, and then we can discuss it as it's in its worked out form. So all in favor of adoption of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. So So Representative Curran, did you want to say any more about the bill as amended right now?
I'll keep it short and just say that there was a ton of work done on this during the interim. I'm immensely grateful to all the stakeholders involved and to both of you chairs for all the conversations we've had to get the bill in the shape that we have before us today. I think we are really in good shape from where we started. I expect the conversation to continue, but this bill today gets us to a place where we can protect judges' personal addresses just for judges in a way that makes sense. According to the laws that we passed last year.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Curran. And I just would comment that this is another great example of really good legislative work, bringing stakeholders together, trying to figure out how to make this work for everybody. And I also feel it's a good step forward. So thank you for your work. Other discussion, member discussion. We already took public testimony on the bill, by the way, so you know, unless there's someone who needs to testify on the changes to the bill today, I don't think we'll take other testimony. But I don't see anyone. So, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Curran, for doing the work on this to get, I think, the bill in a really good place where it's doable and not overwhelming to the county recorders on figuring out, because I don't know any other way for them to do this but manually. So to have potentially 3,000 employees in the judicial branch coming to them and asking for all of that would be quite a lift. So thank you.
All right. Other discussion? Okay. Not seeing any. So final words, Representative Curran.
Just thanks again to everybody involved in this process. I appreciate all the work we can do to protect our judges and their families. Thank you.
All right. Thank you again for your work. And I guess I would just say before we renew the motion and vote the bill out that there was a small fiscal note, very small, and I think it was $18,000. And that might be removed now, actually, with the amendment, because that was some work that the Secretary of State had to do, I believe. And but we are sending it to Ways and Means just in case, right?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. With that, Representative Curran is going to renew the motion that House File 2127, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. And now we are up to House File 2521, Representative Frazier. And Representative Frazier's motion, I believe, is that House File 2521 be placed on the General Register. Is that correct, Representative Frazier? Is that your motion?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. And we do not have an amendment, so go ahead, Representative Frazier. Go ahead and
thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. House File 2521 would clarify Minnesota's post-conviction relief statute by allowing individuals who received the stay of adjudication, not just for those with prior convictions, to petition the court if they believe constitutional rights were violated. This bill addresses a gap created by a recent case, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruling in State v. Johnson, which barred such individuals from seeking relief, even in cases involving ineffective legal counsel or severe immigration consequences. The bill amends Section 590.01 to explicitly include those with stays of adjudication while maintaining existing legal standards, timelines, and judicial safeguards. It reinforces legislative intent, protects due process, and upholds judicial integrity without guaranteeing relief. Judges will still make the determination for each case based on the merits. By passing House File 2521, Minnesota would ensure fair access to justice, reaffirming the state's commitment to constitutional rights and legal accountability. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, the Minnesota State Bar Association, and the Office of the Minnesota Appellate Public Defenders. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to testifiers.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members. My name is Satvir Chaudhry. I'm a private attorney in Minneapolis, testifying as a practitioner in this area of law. I'm also a designee from the State Bar Association and the Board of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and their legislative priorities on this particular bill. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for authoring this bill. I would also add that both of Minnesota's largest prosecutorial counties agencies support this bill as well, Hennepin and Ramsey. As Representative Frazier said, this bill does propose a narrow clarification in the post-conviction statute. We assert that this has that the State v. Johnson decision resulted in what we believe is an unintended denial of constitutional rights to, albeit a limited number, but nonetheless, rights that should apply to everyone. This amendment ensures that the statute functions as we believe originally intended, that if someone's rights were violated in the process of pleading guilty to a crime, then everyone should at least have the opportunity to put that forward. Any guilty plea must be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent to be valid. Sometimes that plea arises, however, out of a violation of someone's rights that induces an unintelligent plea. It happens in many cases. In the case that we're trying to address, State v. Johnston, an Irish citizen was told explicitly by his lawyer that there would be no immigration consequences. So with the case being with the prospect of the case being totally dismissed as part of a stay of adjudication in a relatively short amount of time, he pleaded guilty. However, the plea itself to that particular crime got him deported. When he tried to withdraw the plea, saying that I had gotten improper advice from my attorney, I would not have taken that plea, I would have gone to trial and risked a trial by jury, the court nonetheless said that you can't even try to withdraw your plea or make your argument because stays of adjudications are not technically convictions, and the statute specifically says conviction. But this situation can involve any violation of a constitutional right, whether someone is a U.S. citizen or not. I've represented both in my practice. Collateral consequences on U.S. citizens can stem from minor drug matters, employment, Brady violations, and even cases involving firearm rights. So rather than tinker with the definition of conviction after that after that Supreme Court case, this simply adds stay of adjudication to the allowable types of pleas in order to allow a mere claim of a rights violation. I just want to note that within this process, the way a stay of adjudication works, it is impossible for this proposal to open any type of floodgates to post-conviction petitions. Why? Because withdrawing a guilty plea doesn't erase a case. It just puts it back in front of the court. So to withdraw a plea in a stay of adjudication, a person would have to literally give up the certainty of their case being dismissed and then guaranteed expungement of the criminal charge. So to want to do this, there has to be an enormously good reason to give up this certainty and risk full conviction at trial. So that's why this will only apply to a limited but important constitutional rights situations. And again, the post-conviction statute 290 doesn't guarantee any type of plea withdrawal, only the opportunity to present one's case. So in our view, we can't see that the legislature intended that some people should have this right and not others. And as such, we could consider this to be one of the more technical additions to the statute. But nonetheless, supporting this would affirm our commitment to justice and the protection of constitutional rights for all individuals within Minnesota's legal framework. Thank you, Madam Chair, chairs and members.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a great bill. Like you said, it's not going to cover a million people or open the floodgates, but it addresses a very real issue. And, you know, the definition of conviction in immigration law is different than it is under state law. And so a state of adjudication can absolutely be a conviction for immigration purposes. So this just ensures that people will have the same opportunity to explore post-conviction relief where it might be an option. So thank you.
Feist. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier. I believe I've heard a couple of times examples of immigration being used to say why this bill is needed. Can you give me any other instances in which this would be a pertinent bill to pass?
Go ahead. Mr. Madam Chardin. Chairs and Representative Engen, yes, I can give you an example. Say someone is a defendant is presented with a potential plea of guilty to disorderly conduct, and the prosecution and the defense agree that that would be a just result, and in fact we could do what is called a stay of adjudication, meaning, okay, you plead guilty, but then the judge holds off on the conviction. The plea stays on the record, but after a year, the plea, if probationary conditions are complied with, the plea is vacated and the case is dismissed. That's a typical stay of adjudication. Let's say someone is considering this and asks their lawyer, look, if I plead guilty to this on the record, will my guns get taken away? And the lawyer says, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And so the individual then pleads guilty on the record and states a number of facts that happened to trigger Minnesota's red flag law. And the person who relied on his attorney's advice, who would rather have risked the bringing the facts to a jury than have, you know, certainly have their gun rights affected, has then been induced into a plea that was unintelligent and really involuntary. So they go back and they say, well, this triggered something that I did not intend based on my attorney's advice. It's not the firearms rights that are at issue here. It's the ineffective assistance of counsel. And so I want to go back and assert that I did not receive the type of advice I should have. I want to withdraw my guilty plea because of these consequences. So that's an example where it's in a non-immigration context.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate that very long-winded response. I'm trying to figure out if this is going to destabilize plea agreements. It seems like it would. It seems like plea agreements, which are then settled, and you understand them as settled, now we're going to revert back away from that, and we're going to be able to have post-conviction petitioning for settled cases. That seems like a bad idea to me. It seems like a very bad idea. It seems like it's going to open up the floodgates, despite your very articulate and long-winded reasoning as to why it wouldn't. I believe it will. So I would like to motion for a roll call on this, please, Madam Chair.
Okay, roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ingen, I appreciate your comments. So this will not open the floodgates for the reasons that were stated before. It doesn't remove any of the timelines and procedural processes that are currently in place for post-fixing relief. And post-conviction relief has not, and we've had post-conviction relief, can't pronounce today, post-conviction relief for a long time within our justice system. It exists around the country, and that's in cases where you have actually had situations where it's gone to jury, there's been a conviction, and we would consider that to be settled. It has not upended those jury trials and those convictions that have been put in place in terms of a floodgate situation that you just noted. This would not change any of that. The same procedures and standards would be in place, and the judge would have to determine whether or not that case moved forward based on the merits. It only allows for individuals in those particular situations, and we've noted in those situations that although it would be very narrow, it's important that we are looking out for justice overall and making sure that limited number of people are also captured as well.
Madam Chairs and
Mr. Chaudhry,
and I would just add that it is a constitutional rule that a plea must be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And if that plea is not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, because of any number of violation of rights, it could be evidence that was not presented properly or misadvice from an attorney, that plea is already unstable. And so a just result is something that will come from something that is knowing. Now, the reason why we don't have to worry about that is because if someone withdraws that plea, that very good plea, that remember, a stay of adjudication is certain dismissal of their case in a relatively short amount of time. So to want to do that, you have to have a very good reason to put your case back to the beginning and risk going to trial for it.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To your testifier and yourself, Representative Frazier, do you know what percentage of cases are receive stays of adjudication in Hennepin and Ramsey County?
Representative Frazier.
Madam Chair, Representative Egan, I do not have that number. I can see if we can get it for you.
Representative Egan?
Madam Chair, it's 82%. So we are opening up the floodgates. I really appreciate all the reasonings as to why you don't believe so, but that's a very, very large percentage of cases that we're talking about here. And, yeah, again, I would just request a roll call. Thank you.
All right. Representative Frazier.
Yeah, just one last comment. Representative Egan, I'll say this. Many of the cases in this state and in this country are often resolved through the plea agreement method. This does not remove any of the procedures and guardrails that allow for a judge to take that case under consideration based on the merits. And there are also timelines in place as well. So, again, I will say this will not open up floodgates. Those guardrails would still be in place.
Just a factual correction, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chaudhry.
Representative Ingen. 82% of the cases in the county that you say don't end up in stays of adjudication. I think what you perhaps what you meant is that 82% end up in pleas. But we're not talking about pleas. This is only regards to pleas involving stays of adjudication. And so that is a very finite, narrow number of people, and those people are guaranteed dismissal of their case in a short amount of time. So there's built-in prevention discouragement from wanting to put it back before before the judge and a jury, and you'd have to have a very good reason to want to choose to do that, and it is that person's choice too.
Okay, I'm going to go to Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just heard that number, and that didn't seem right about stays of adjudication. And just so people understand, there's also stay of imposition and stay of execution, which are very different from stays of adjudication. And so that's where I was thinking maybe that number was coming from, and just wanted to make that note. But I'm seeing some nods from across the aisle, and that's what it sounds like. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Steer.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Have we consulted with the County Attorneys Association on this? And if so, what's their position?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have had conversations with the county attorneys. They did raise some questions. Many of those questions have been answered because they've been in conversations with the individuals that are testifying here today and also the Bar Association. But they're more than happy to speak for themselves if you'd like to hear from them. I believe there's someone in the room.
Representative Steer, do you want someone to come up?
I would if there's somebody from the County Attorneys Association. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Small. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Before this bill was introduced, we met twice with members of the Bar Association. We had some concerns that we shared before the bill was entered. We shared those concerns. One of those concerns is there's actually a rule of procedure that allows these cases to be heard by the courts. From the Bar Association's perspective, that was a little bit more restrictive than their proposal, and they wanted it in statute rather than by rule. We were concerned about resources and the number of cases. We asked, county attorneys don't only deal on post-conviction matters with felony matters, they also deal with misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors that were handled by city attorneys. And so there's a lot of resource heavy work that goes into any post-conviction, and we asked for further conversation to occur to try to limit the number of cases that would be brought, and unfortunately, we never heard back from the Bar Association.
Representative Steer?
So I'm sorry, I didn't directly answer your question. So okay, at Small. The time the bill came forward, because we hadn't heard back from the Bar Association, we opposed the bill.
Mm-hmm. Representative Steer?
Okay, so just to recap, so the County Attorneys Association does not support the current bill in its form.
Mr. Small, is that accurate?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's accurate.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope that I would love to see this. Is this going to the General Register? I feel like this, I don't know, needs more work before it goes there. I don't, we're going to be meeting several times this week. I don't know if, Madam Chair, if you would entertain just laying it over while some work would continue with the county attorney's office, then we can bring it back if there's peace in the valley and so forth. I feel like this is a situation where we need to have all stakeholders, you know, thinking that this is a good bill. So, Madam Chair, not to put you on the spot, but to put you on the spot, would you be willing to just lay this over until there's probably some peace in the valley?
So I thank you, Chair Scott. And I guess I would make a comment on the bill, and then I would leave it up to the author whether he wants to lay it over. I mean, it's, you know. But appreciate putting me on the spot. That's okay. That's the job, right? We're on the spot all the time. But I think it would be up to the author. But let me just say, you know, I not recently, but I have practiced law and I've done post-conviction proceedings. And I think it's kind of arbitrary to just say that if you got a stay of adjudication, you don't get to, you're just locked out from post-conviction relief, just locked out. And apparently that had to be clarified by a court case, which I hadn't read that court case, but you know, it's this is about people's constitutional rights ultimately. And I think when it comes to making sure that people have constitutional rights in this state, we should err on the side of making sure they do, not saying, oh, we're worried it's a little too much work and so on. So I appreciate I appreciate there are always resource issues. That's a reality. But I do hope we can get this worked out because I think it's important, even though it seems to me to be almost a technical change. Maybe it is actually a technical change. Anyway, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Representative Frazier to let us know your pleasure here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like the testifier to speak for a moment before I answer the question about whether or not I would consider laying it over to come back.
All right, Mr. Chaudhry.
Madam Chairs, members, I think Mr. Small and I share differing recollections of our conversations. We feel that the concerns that were raised were completely addressed. I think the one suggestion to narrow the scope of the bill involved limiting it to just immigration circumstances. And as a practitioner in the area, I think that would defeat the purpose of the bill for constitutional rights to apply to everyone, regardless of how many people it will apply to, even if it's a very small number of people. That doesn't seem fair that only certain rights should be allowed under states of adjudication and not all. So as far as kind of restricting the language, that it just doesn't seem to be the tenable way to do it. We were hoping from the process, you know, the NCAA to get back to us after some reflection on our the way we've addressed this issue, which I think has been adequate. You know, the two largest counties that will deal with any, let's just say there was an influx. There won't be. Say there was. The two counties that would endure the impact both support this bill. The MSBA criminal law section is the only organization in Minnesota that has both defense lawyers and prosecutors in it, and after reviewing this proposal, unanimously supported it with with prosecutors voting in its favor. So I think this is a very much a consensus bill the way it is.
All right. Well, thank you. So the question, so it looks like some conversations are happening. I don't know, Representative Fraser, what we could do is lay the bill over, take up your, well, you're going to be busy in the meantime, so you won't have time to work anything out. I was going to say maybe we could come back today now in 10 minutes and finish, but what's your pleasure here?
I'm okay with laying it over. We'll get this worked out.
All right, so we will lay the bill over and continue to work on it and hope we'll get a resolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so the next is, the last bill is Representative Frazier's bill again, House File 689. And Representative Frazier's motion here will be that House File 689 be re-referred to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. Still working on here. And Representative Frazier. All right. Maybe so House File 689. So your motion is to move it to workforce.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Please go ahead and present the bill.
So House File 689 addresses the widespread issue of wage theft in Minnesota, particularly in the construction industry, where one in five workers experience unpaid wages or denied overtime. This unethical practice harms workers, undercuts honest businesses, and reduces state tax revenue. To combat wage theft, House File 689 grants county attorneys the authority to issue administrative subpoenas, enabling them to access business records related to wages and employment conditions. This empowers prosecutors to hold employers accountable and deter violations. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, SEIU Local 26, the Carpenters, AFL-CIO, and Ramsey County Attorney Office. House File 689 strengthens enforcement efforts and ensures workers receive fair compensation. By passing this bill, Minnesota reaffirms its commitment to justice and a fair labor market. With that, Madam Chair, I will have a testifiers come up.
All right, thank you. So, Brian Walsh, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony, and kind of running low on time, so if you could be brief, please.
Understood, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Walsh. I am an Associate Director of Civil Rights and the Director of Labor Standards Enforcement for the City of Minneapolis. Several years ago, not too long after the legislature explicitly added wage theft to the criminal theft statute, I had the experience of trying to refer a case of wage theft to the county attorney's office. I found incredibly dedicated people without all the necessary tools and evidence to take the case. It took many months and many fits and starts. What I learned was that financial crimes and fraud investigators are stretched incredibly thin, always asked to do more with less. I also learned that many financial crimes and fraud cases require more evidence to prove than other types of cases. The bill before you provides prosecutors the same administrative subpoena power they already have in other similar cases, allowing them to more closely collaborate with and lighten the load on law enforcement. As Representative Frazier noted, all of this matters because wage theft and payroll fraud put downward pressure on wages across entire industries, put honest employers at a competitive disadvantage, remove millions from state coffers, effectively forcing the rest of us to pick up the tab. Many people in the city of Minneapolis and across the state certainly live paycheck to paycheck. If an employee steals from an employer, we expect the case to be prosecuted. We should expect the same when employers commit wage theft and payroll fraud. This bill helps us do just that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. A member discussion. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And at risk of repeating, are the county attorneys okay with this? We're giving them some new authority. Is there a fiscal note expected with this? Are there going to be a lot of cases that they're now going to be investigating? Those are a couple of questions that I have, and maybe you have the answer to those since you're the author of the bill.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair. I don't have a fiscal note. So I can't speak to that, and I have not heard any objections on this bill from the county attorney's office, from the county attorney association.
And I see over there, we're getting a thumbs up over there from Mr. Small. And I would just say that as I look at the bill, the way it's written, it just gives authority, which I don't know that that would have a cost. I mean, if they use the authority, you know, they have control over it, how much they resource they put into it, I assume. Does that
That would be correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Other discussion?
Just one follow-up question, because I am not an attorney that looks into this stuff, but why an administrative subpoena versus a warrant on something like that? What's the deciding factor between the two of those for us novices?
Right now, with the warrant, that only allows for they have to have probable cause to get that warrant. Many of these cases can get stalled out because they can't develop the probable cause when the prosecutors are trying to look into the case. The administrative subpoena, which they can use for any other cases that they're looking into investigate, this would allow them the same opportunities for these wage theft cases. So right now they are very limited in how they can look into these wage theft cases, which is what Mr. Walsh was describing.
Thank you. Chair Scott. Okay. Other discussion? All right. Seeing none.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative Steer.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'm just confused on this. This can't be a statewide issue. Where I work, we do the administrative subpoenas. We send it in.
Representative Steer, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Sorry, I speak low, I guess. So I'm wondering if this is a statewide issue or if we're just looking at a couple different counties. The county I work in, law enforcement does the administrative subpoenas, and I don't know if this would be a useful tool for the county attorneys in, say, Scott or Carver County. Are we trying to hit the whole entire state, or is this regionalized?
Mr. Walsh?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, is certainly a statewide issue, and the administrative subpoena statute applies to all county attorney's offices across the state and would do so equally. The wage theft is certain, and the investigation and prosecution of such cases is certainly a statewide issue.
Yeah, so let me just ask a follow-up question to that. So this bill doesn't mean that law enforcement would not be doing it. It just also gives the tool to the prosecutors so that they could also do it. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Thank you. Representative Vangen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier. I definitely agree with the crux of what you're trying to get to here. But does this allow for direct administrative power with no court oversight? You know, these subpoenas that are binding and have no oversight authority as to whether or not they're just being imposed willy-nilly.
Mr. Walsh or Representative Frazier, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you administer these subpoenas, it wouldn't change the ability of an attorney for the individual, for the organization where the subpoena has been administered, for them to take the ability to fight the subpoena. That would not change.
Representative Vangen?
Say that one more time, Representative Frazier, there's no judicial check before the subpoena is issued.
The organizations. Madam Chair, thank you. This would not prevent organizations from having the ability to defend themselves or push back on these subpoenas from prosecution, if that's your question.
Yeah. Representative Engen, final word, because we need to get finished here. Okay. Final word, Representative Frazier.
Madam Chair, I think just to reiterate back to, I think one of the comments made by Representative Steer is that, yeah, this wage theft issue is a statewide issue. That is why, and the fact that this tool doesn't exist now for prosecutors, and the fact that the Minnesota County Attorney's Association supports this, it is a tool that prosecutors feel they need to have in their toolbox in order to go to attack an issue that is very prevalent here in the state of Minnesota.
All right. Thank you. So so Representative Frazier is going to renew his motion that House File 689 be re-referred to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is on its way. So with that, members, we are adjourned.